I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. In this computer age, we live more or less consciously in a world of algorithms, meaning those programmed sets of step-by-step instructions written in a symbolic vocabulary, instructions that execute themselves, 1, 2, 3, without emotion or intelligence or insight until the job is done. Algorithms are the complex but firm formulas in a computer program that give us confidence in its consistency. But there is a logic in algorithms that's much older than 20th century computers. The Enlightenment scientists like Leibniz and Newton crystallized a lot of modern thinking about algorithms. Aristotle had anticipated them in ancient Greece. The latest thinking is that algorithmic process has been the regulating rule of variation and adaptation in millions of years of biological evolution, maybe even in the development of the physical universe since the Big Bang. So what is this algorithmic code? How many algorithms are there? Would we know one, Connection listeners, if it bit us? 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. David Berlinski, our guest, is a mathematician with a prose style. He made a marvelous literary work out of the calculus a few years ago. The Advent of the Algorithm is his sequel, and just in time. The algorithm, he says, is the idea that rules the world. Come to class, Connection listeners, at 1-800-423-TALK. We're learning about algorithms. It reminds me of parameter. Do we really want to know the real meaning of parameter when most of us use it as if it meant perimeter?
No, not me. Not me, certainly not.
Let's crack this algorithm thing. How do you use it? How do you explain it to your distant aunts?
Well, like any other interesting concept, it has a double meaning and so a double identity. In the context of computer science, any kind of specialized context, an algorithm is a program. It's a piece of code that's been specifically designed and created to execute a certain task. And we're all completely familiar with the idea of an algorithm. After all, when we push something into a computer and we expect the computer to run, what we're pushing into the computer is an algorithm. It's a program. But like every other interesting concept in mathematics or in science generally, an algorithm is a concept that has deep roots in human consciousness as well. Algorithms standing in a loose sense for any symbolic artifact that breaks up the flow of time, interposing a finite set of instructions between human desires and their fulfillment. And this, of course, is an ancient racial apparatus, the race being the human race. We use algorithms in a great variety of contexts. A recipe is an obvious example, but your tax code is another example. Any kind of artifact, a symbolic artifact of this form, belongs to the large and noble category of algorithms, understood as cultural artifacts. So there's this double sense to an algorithm. It has a profound human importance. It has a specific technical meaning as well.
Well, how complex does it have to be an algorithm? I mean, if I say to the dog, heel or I'll hit you, that's not an algorithm, is it?
Depends who's listening, the dog or another human interlocutor. It could be a very short algorithm, but of course one doubts very, very much, very strenuously, whether the dog is capable of an act of interpretation that could process that algorithm. I don't know. I don't know a whole lot about dog psychology. But length is not the governing consideration. The governing consideration is that an algorithm must be a finite sequence of discrete steps that can be executed either by a human being or a computer without any supervening intelligence or intuition. Not only must it fulfill these properties, but it has to come to an end, as we must all come to an end as well. So an algorithm belongs to a specific class of symbolic forms. I don't think a command would count as an algorithm.
Well, you started with a recipe. If you add the chocolate chips at the right moment, you will end up with Toll House cookies.
That's the theory. It never works for me, but I understand it works for other people.
Yeah, it's a tricky example because they all come out differently. What's your 101 or 202 example of an algorithm?
Any kind of simple software that you put into a computer counts as an algorithm. Any kind of very explicit recipe, let's forget about Toll House cookies. Let's take a recipe for building a birdcage, the sort of thing we all endeavor to do in elementary school. Take the lumber, assemble it at right angles, put the nail here, put another nail there, paint the whole thing, and when you've done all those steps in the right sequence, you'll have a birdcage. That counts as an algorithm as well. A word processing program is simply an algorithm. A manual for typing, touch typing, comprises an algorithm. A simple set of commands. If you want to see the letter P appear on the computer screen, depress the button with a P marked on it. If you want to write the word dog, execute D-O-G in the correct sequence. Those are all algorithms. They're very short. They're not particularly interesting, but they are algorithms. They convey the essence of the idea. Sequence of steps. Finite sequence of discrete steps.
So a more complex algorithm would do what? Would estimate government revenues from personal income taxes over the next 10 years?
Yeah, there are input-output algorithms that would perform exactly those functions in macroeconomics. There's really no upper bound on the complexity of a possible algorithm. But bear in mind, an algorithm works because it iterates very simple steps. Figure out human destiny is a command, but it's not an algorithm because it does not break down its instruction set into simple sets. Human destiny is not a concept with a multiple. Incarnation is a series of discrete and iterable items. So the complexity of an algorithm is misleading. You can have an algorithm, for example, Windows 98 or Windows 2000. You've got about 30 million, 40 million lines of code. And that sounds like it's an inordinately complicated object. But in fact, when you look at the code, or if we could look at the code, if Microsoft disclosed it, we would see very simple steps. Move left, move right, go through this gate, go through that gate, add this column, look in this memory bank. All of the steps being remarkably simple in their conceptual nature. Remarkably simple.
But the net of them being enormously, not so much complex as...
big.
Yeah.
Real big. And that's a surprising discovery. That's a discovery that I would say is relatively unexpected in the context of 20th century logic and 20th century science in general, that one can gain the impression of overwhelming complexity by iterating very simple steps very quickly. That is not exactly what we intuitively think of as complexity. We think of complexity as involving something more than the iteration of a lot of simple steps. And that points to a profound mystery, not only in the biological sciences, but in sciences generally. That is, we have an intuition about complexity, we have certain hunches about complexity, but we have really no deep, no powerful theory of complexity, except for this notion of algorithmic complexity, which involves iterations of steps undertaken many, many times.
But the complexity idea also requires, it would seem to require, some doubt, some mystery, some variation, something unexplainable, a surprise coming out of the algorithm, which you say it isn't there. The algorithm is to do the same thing every time. It's to be completely predictable, and it's to get to its goal no matter what.
Predictability might not be the right concept. I mean, after all, if you take a whole batch of complicated algorithms on a computer, just because the size is so extraordinarily large, in any practical sense, we cannot predict what the computer will be. I mean, if you have two programs of 30 million lines of code running simultaneously, even though computer programmers may have looked at the thing for years and years and years, there are plenty of surprises built in because every particular permutation or combination has not been examined. It's humanly impossible. So even though an algorithm is quite fixed, it's quite deterministic, it's supposed to do exactly what we want the thing to do, nonetheless, the sheer size of various algorithms make prediction a practical impossibility. That's something we discover all the time. We send up a space shuttle, the thing malfunctions. After it returns to Earth, if it returns to Earth, we discover, well, line 750,000 of this particular code didn't interface properly with line 231 of that particular code, and an unexpected glitch developed. The computer shut down, it malfunctioned, it fired the thruster by accident. These are very familiar facts of our experience. But the point that I would like to emphasize is that even though they are familiar, even though we quite understand there are limits to our own ability to predict the consequences of these algorithmic artifacts, that does not seem quite to touch on the mystery of complexity itself. That seems a separate problem, a richer, a deeper, different problem. For example, complexity of biological organization. that doesn't quite seem to be touched on by concepts that we have at hand in algorithmic theory right now.
Is that you talking or
you bet.
Science in general?
No, that's me talking.
Yeah, all right.
That's me talking.
Because it seems to me when I listen to scientists talk about algorithms, more often than not, they're trying to say that there is no mystery, no room for mystery in the kind of endless iteration, as you say, of the simple steps in the algorithm's instructions. There may be some things we didn't anticipate, a glitch in outer space, but the algorithm was doing its thing in a totally determined way.
Well, certainly people can say, they can affirm grandly there's no room for mystery, but that depends entirely on the standards of success being employed. One can look at the panorama of biological life and say, hey, I don't see anything mysterious. One thing just follows another. But I think when that attitude is exposed to serious and severe questioning, it very quickly evaporates.
Well, do it. It's cross question here. One of your scientists who says there's no mystery in this process, it just keeps on grinding, and you say, wait just a minute. How would that argument present itself?
Well, let's answer that argument in the two largest senses of a possible answer. For one thing, we have absolutely no understanding of the origin of life in terms of the problem of explaining how organic life arose from inorganic matter. Every attempt to provide an extremely plausible, tight-knit scenario has so far failed. That's one large aspect. The second aspect is that even though we have an extraordinarily rich, detailed body of molecular biological knowledge, the most profound processes that we see, even on the level of the bacterial cell, remain enigmatic, remain almost completely mysterious. Even to the extent that we lack a vocabulary to describe properly what we're seeing. By a vocabulary, I mean a respectable scientific vocabulary. Every time that we attempt to elucidate the structure of even the bacterial cell, a simple form of life, we're thrown back on ancestral metaphors. The thing has a certain purpose, it's going a certain way, it's self-regulating, it's self-organizing. But all of these metaphors are, in the end, just that. They're metaphors. We cannot cash them in yet. So both in terms of the origin of life and in terms of its contemporary, in terms of our contemporary understanding of its nature, we find ourselves baffled at every turn. To say that these are algorithmic processes, well, You certainly cannot be faulted for saying that, because it's an empty content. In terms of that discussion, what isn't an algorithmic process? Until one actually specifies in terms of a detailed theory how life could have arisen by an algorithmic process, or how the bacterial cell can organize itself by an algorithm, until we can actually specify these kind of algorithms, they must remain as metaphors.
This is really important. And tell me if I'm keeping score properly here. What you're really saying is that the algorithm is everything. It is the device that not only regulates computers, but maybe everything. But once you said that, it's almost meaningless. I mean, you're saying that it is almost meaningless as an explanation for why we are the way we are, or how we got here, or what started it.
No, I'm not saying it's almost meaningless. I'm saying it is meaningless. That is, it's an empty ceremonial gesture.
Well, I bring it up only because there are those, and I'm thinking of Dan Dennett especially, who says that when in trying to solve the mystery of consciousness or why we're here, he says, it's an algorithmic process, and that's the answer to your question.
Sure. How can you lose saying that? How could you possibly lose? Algorithmic process meaning computable. Computable meaning it proceeds in steps. Proceeds in steps meaning there's something we might one day be able to specify that explains what that is.
Well, he means specifically that there is a formula of variation in living species, and maybe in planetary systems, too.
Who doubts it? Who could doubt it? Sure, things are different. There's variation. Not all stars look alike. Not all species look alike. I mean, but that's really on the level of triviality, isn't it? I mean, there's simply no content to that assertion because it's irrefutable. There's a level of parametric variation, sure.
Yeah, but he says in arguments about creation or design or purpose in this evolution, he would say, and has often said in this program, don't kid yourself, it's simply a natural limp in the program that automatically sets off a mutation, a change, and an adaptation, and then the next thing. That's your explanation. You're saying it doesn't explain much of anything.
I'm not saying it doesn't explain much of anything. I'm saying it doesn't explain anything whatsoever because it's a complete triviality. It's a completely empty concept.
Talk about algorithm as a metaphor then. It's a metaphor that's really become popular out of computer world.
Sure.
It is this complex program set of instructions that gets to a target somehow, and in computer cases with amazing speed and cleanliness and
sure.
No neuroses or whatnot. My general sense is sort of in a conversational way, algorithm has then been sort of applied historically to everything else that came before. There was infinite space one time, and an algorithm kicked in, and it's been kicking in at regular intervals for 18 billion years or whatever till we get to this point. That it is used metaphorically as a substitute for creation or for a plan or for, I mean, it was sort of, it's the DNA before DNA, right?
I don't see how, with any confidence, you can say of an algorithm that it is the substitute for creation or a substitute for a plan. After all,
it's almost God's logic, though. It's God's DNA or something.
I don't know. I think we should reserve God's logic for God. That's pretty much hidden from our sight right now. But if you want to make certain claims about algorithms, you should really respect their conceptual nature. Two things to remember about an algorithm. One, it is a symbolic artifact that is a human creation. And as such, it's infused with human intelligence. If we start talking about cosmological algorithms, and we respect the boundaries of the metaphor, we're bound to ask, well, in what language are these algorithms written, and whose intelligence is infusing them? We have really no explanation how a cosmological algorithm could have just popped up in the void. That's not an explanation. That's part of myth-making. If we're really serious about arguing that the Big Bang, for example, and all of creation subsequent thereof followed an algorithm, let us have some specification of the author of the algorithm and the nature of the intelligence that's reflected in the algorithm. If you're going to argue there is no author and no intelligence, then you've broken the boundary of the metaphor because the algorithms we understand are infused with intelligence. They're our creation. Do we really want to argue in terms of a natural program of science that we rest easy with a concept of a cosmological algorithm but refuse to acknowledge that algorithms are infused with intelligence and that are simultaneously human creations? That is stretching the metaphor to a breaking point. And that's one reason why this entire apparatus, when stretched to this extent, is largely ceremonial. It's empty. The curse of Western science to invoke these ceremonial ideas again and again and again.
David Berlinski is our guest. His book is The Advent of the Algorithm. A very popular notion, popular, probably misunderstood in this computer age, and a metaphor for almost everything, but certainly often used as a metaphor for processes of variation, evolution, adaptation, the development of intelligence, the development of us. 1-800-423-8255 makes the algorithm connection. Richard is on the line.
Hi, I'm very sympathetic, Chris, with what you're trying to figure out, but, you know, you can't get there from here.
Okay.
That's what your guest is trying to tell you.
It's always been my problem.
Yes. I want to put it a little bit of, I'm a physician and a psychiatrist, so I'm among those who suffer at the hands of algorithms every day, and their replacement for intelligence. I mean, I think they specifically, algorithms reflect, in fact, the absence of human intelligence. Because what they do is they try to reduce to a formula something which is, in fact, can't be formulated, at least on the individual basis. So, if, for example, in medicine, we see clerks at computers using algorithms to deal with the symptoms patients call in to complain about, and the algorithm decides what they are likely to have on a statistical population basis, and then send the patient off to whatever the average expectable care is. So what the algorithm does is it's a statement of probability, it's a statement of likelihood, which we are, in a kind of idolatrous way, confusing with reality.
I think that's an extremely important point, and if I could expand on it just very briefly, I think what you're really pointing out is something profoundly engaging about the algorithm, in that in order to achieve an effective algorithm, one has to withdraw from the symbolic apparatus all traces of its meaning.
That's right.
A computer, after all, does not contemplate the programs that it's executing. But at the same time, every algorithm, because it's infused with human intelligence, also represents a form of meaning that we hide from ourselves when we use an algorithm for a computer. So every act of algorithmic interpretation involves the immemorial aspect of remembering and simultaneously forgetting what we're doing. We understand quite well what an addition program means, but when we write the code for an addition program, we deliberately suppress our understanding of its meaning so that it can be executed profitably. And this is part of the double nature of the algorithm.
And the emphasis on profit, it's very important. It's all about profit because, in economic sense, it's profit which is the algorithmic bottom line. And when you have a simple number like a profit that you're aiming at, then the algorithm becomes important. But it can't look at individual cases the way we as subjective individuals consider ourselves. And so you have algorithmic arguments like, do seatbelts save lives? Well, on average they do, but what if you're trapped in a burning car? Or what about gun control? There are all these arguments which are entered into statistically as an algorithm in general what's going to happen, but the individual case is always an exception, and that's our emotional subjective conflict with the algorithm. It goes back to ancient Greece when the guy with the hypotenuse, Pythagoras, I guess, was among the first to say, well, the world is really numbers. It's not really feelings or intuitions. The true forms and shapes underneath everything are numbers. A pound of lead weighs just as much as a pound of feathers.
Once you
have the pound, then you've lost all meaning, and you enter a purely mathematical algorithmic world.
Richard, you know too much, and you say it too well, and you may have got there from here. You're listening to The Connection, and the phone is 1-800-423-8255. Richard?
Yes.
I never want to let you go.
I'm here.
But when you say you can't get there from here,
right,
you mean...
There has to be another kind of explanation which applies to how we experience reality subjectively.
That's for sure.
And we don't have that in the scientific world. In fact, the whole point of the scientific world is to look at everything objectively, which reduces what we think of as the subject to a point.
You're right. You're racing too far ahead. I mean, I disagree that the point of an algorithm is to reduce everything to an objective reality. I don't agree with that at all.
Why?
Because I think an algorithm is a human creation. It's designed for human purposes. It's written with specific human needs in mind. And in this respect, it's very different from the long tradition of mathematical physics in which an objective world was assumed, a book of nature that could be read by specialists.
Right.
That's why the algorithm is the second of the great scientific ideas. It is an intensely human artifact. An intensely human artifact.
But Richard, you're driving at something that interests me too, and it has to do with this whole consciousness question, another one of Dan Dennett's ideas. It seems to me the algorithm is used to serve the goal of arguing against subjectivity, against consciousness, against individual perspective, against, I hate to throw this right in here, but I mean, against sort of... The spiritual mystery of the individual mind.
How could the algorithm be used to argue against consciousness? I mean, that's an absurd claim. I open my eyes are filled. Now, that is a fact. It's also a mystery. It's a mystery for which we have absolutely no adequate vocabulary and no scientific understanding whatsoever. But that having been said, it is nonetheless a fact. Human beings are conscious. They have conscious experiences. And as closely as we can determine, our sense of consciousness is continuous. Since it is continuous, that means it belongs to a different aspect of our experience than the algorithm, which is discrete.
Oh, no.
Richard?
Yes.
Do you follow that?
Yes, I do, and he's being quite idealistic, but not right. The algorithm is only applies to corporate needs, to social needs. It cannot be... And it applies only to populations of data which it describes on average. It can't, I mean, my Windows system crashes all the time. Any individual event, he calls it complexity. That's just like That's a hedge factor in objectivity. It just means that something subjective may be in the system that you haven't isolated yet. You can't have an algorithm applied to an individual event. An algorithm.
Oh, the algorithmic faction will apply to anything, I think, Richard. Will it not? I mean,
well, there's so many claims going off like firecrackers now. I don't know which ones I agree with and which ones I disagree with. I think we should factor out all questions of corporate profit because they're completely tangential to my own concerns, the profit of my book accepted. It is very plausible to argue with respect to subjective experiences or with respect to mental phenomena in general that in some sense an algorithmic process underlies believing, wishing, hoping, thinking, fearing, desiring, the full range of mental powers and properties. It's a plausible hypothesis. Indeed, I regard it as the deepest hypothesis currently available in psychology, which is not to say it's very deep at all. Having said that, there's plenty of room to argue in addition that there is some profoundly ineffable mystery beyond that. Because after all, every time we've come a certain way in terms of specifying a psychological process in algorithmic terms, we are still left with a profound mystery. Vision is a perfect example. We know quite a bit about the algorithmic basis of vision. It's not coherent knowledge yet. But at the end of every algorithm, there's the question, what enables me to see? Seeing is an experience. It's not the conclusion of a line of code.
The algorithm of the clock says it's time to take a short break. We're talking about algorithms with the author David Berlinski. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the algorithm with David Berlinski. He calls the algorithm the second great idea of Western science, the first being calculus. Calculus made mathematics possible. The algorithm made the world possible. 1-800-423-8255. What color is your algorithm, Connection listeners? 1-800-423-8255. Julia is on the line.
Hello.
Good morning, Julia.
Hi. When I teach my freshmen in the introductory philosophy class that I teach, I tell them that Immanuel Kant made moral reasoning into an algorithm and that the categorical imperative is, and in fact, an algorithm that allows us to take any moral question, run it through the process, and come up with an answer. And Kant believed that this was a universal, supreme moral principle and so was good for all people at all times under all situations, which seems to me to be a perfect example of an algorithm that is used for individual situations in contrast to what your previous caller was claiming.
David Berlinski.
I'll try choking my answer out again. It seems to me that it's important not to confuse a technical concept with every conceivable instantiation in terms of philosophy or moral reasoning. I mean, Kant's categorical imperative is a rule. It's a moral rule. Let every action be judged insofar as it could be a principle for all mankind. Mm-hmm. But that has to be interpreted. In fact, there's a rich body of moral theory that's devoted just to that, interpreting what on earth Kant could have possibly meant in the face of all sorts of possible counterexamples. In that sense, because it's a richly meaningful asseveration, it does not yet count as an algorithm. You cannot put that on a computer and spew out moral judgments because the computer will simply come back and say, I have no idea what this particular line of code means. It's not written in any form that it's recognizable in machine terms. So I think it's very important to distinguish between the algorithmic skeleton, which may in fact be there, and the rich embroidery, the tapestry of meaning, which Kant affixed to his own declaration. I don't agree it's an algorithmic affirmation.
No, I mean, but wouldn't you say that it's at least more algorithmic than other sorts of moral reasoning? For example, Aristotelian reasoning, which is much more involved with human practice and virtue?
No, I don't. I think Kant's categorical imperative is an extremely interesting moral doctrine, but it requires exactly the same body of interpretation as, say, the Nicomachean Ethics.
Mm.
It simply is not a self-revealing statement. It's part of the eternal low babble of human needs and moral concerns. It's a very powerful moral insight, but it's no different from anything else in moral philosophy. It has not yet crossed the algorithmic threshold so that we can see instantiated in the categorical imperative a finite, discrete, symbolic apparatus that can be implemented without any significant intelligence or intuition on the part of the user.
Judy, we're getting to sound like my freshman roommate, you know, Philosophy 10 and all that, categorical imperatives and instantiations and the Nicomachean Ethics, which are Aristotle's ethics.
Will we ever then be able to use algorithms for anything that we would consider to be a sort of broadly humanistic pursuit?
God only knows. I mean, these are such important, profound questions, I wouldn't know how to begin to answer it, because you're asking me to anticipate the next 100 or 200 years of development in human thought. What we do have on hand is the promise of an idea that we might be able to explain certain aspects of human psychology in computational terms. We have a second promising idea that we might be able to explain some aspects of life in computational terms. But we shouldn't exaggerate what we really have on hand. I mean, we have enlarged the margins of our understanding, but as the radius of the circle increases, the circumference increases as well, and the enveloping darkness is every bit as obscure as it ever was. We shouldn't ask too much of these concepts.
Julia, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the algorithm connection. Kathy is on the line.
Hello,
Kathy.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, I'm getting an echo. I don't know, after Richard and your guest's last statement, what I originally wanted to do was quarrel with the idea that we have no algorithms or that biology cannot be expressed in an algorithm. And we know a great deal, and your guest keeps coming back to feeding something into the computer, but as a biologist, I come back to putting things in a test tube and then being able to say in individual discrete steps what will happen.
Oh, I don't disagree at all. I think that's exactly right. I think there are countlessly many interesting biochemical processes that we can describe in a step-by-step fashion. I don't have the slightest intention of disagreeing with it. What I do suggest, though, is that there are still many, many profound and provocative questions that do not yield to this kind of analysis. For example, take the bacterial cell. Take the fact that proteins form spontaneously into certain three-dimensional shapes. Oh, for 10 or 15 years, biochemists imagined that we could explain this by saying that just like a rubber band, when stretched, it goes back to its lowest free energy state. Well and good. Turns out the story is infinitely more complicated. Certain proteins require molecular chaperones in order to achieve their proper state. When they perform their function in the cell, an entirely new class of biochemicals enters the scene in order to degrade the proteins. Well, this sounds like a step-by-step process. It's a fascinating thing to look at in biochemical terms, but we have no idea, except for a ceremonial invocation of the algorithm, how it's actually achieved.
1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks for taking the call. And this is an interesting topic for me because I've been designing algorithms to study cardiac function for about 5 years now. Hmm. And I'm responsible for the ones that are used in cardiac defibrillators. I had some comments on complexity, but I also wanted to go back to the first caller's understanding of algorithms and how I think he's confusing the actual algorithm itself from the interpretation of the algorithm, which is something entirely different. So algorithms, as I see it, are a way to model experiences and it's up to the, and it produces an output, and then you have to properly understand what went in and what the algorithm is used for in order to determine whether the outcome is appropriate for
sure,
the input.
Sure, that's absolutely right.
And as I see it, algorithms are more than just a repetition, but also a decision process where you have a decision tree of, in this case, now what do I do? I can do A or B or any number of things. And what the algorithm does is say, well, based on a certain group of things, inputs to start out with, I will follow this decision logic and decide on, in my case, whether or not a cardiac shock is desirable.
Sure. Sure, you can have branching algorithms, you have decision points, all sorts of complicated structures can be built into an algorithm.
And so that's how complexity kind of can work into it, at least in the algorithms that we design at my company.
Mike, it sounds like interesting work. I mean, you're an algorithm designer and you're making what would be called designer algorithms. But I want to take the conversation back to the metaphor. Part of the metaphor that you're working on, it seems to me, David Berlinski, implies a great big challenge to the Darwinian assumptions, but also to a lot of the working assumptions of cognitive science, and maybe even to Big Bang astronomy. Do you want to open that door?
Sure, let's open it wide. My position is simple and almost trite. I see nothing of explanatory value in Darwinian theory, nothing whatsoever. I think it's one of the large empty structures of the contemporary world, a natural successor to Marxism and Freudianism, soon to follow it in the graveyard of
well,
good ideas.
It preceded surely Freudianism, but you, really...
No, I'm talking a natural successor in the graveyard. It will soon be joining other spent spirits in the graveyard of dead ideas.
What in the world is going to be a better explanation of how the world got here?
Beats me. I think these questions should be treated with a certain amount of humility. We really don't have a good explanation.
What's wrong with Darwinism?
It's empty. It's completely empty. It doesn't tell us anything of particular interest. And when looked at scientifically in terms of the great structures that we have in mathematical physics, it's a lamentably trivial theory. I mean, what does it after all tell us? That there's a certain differential variation in a population and certain survivors will survive. Well, that's terrific. I mean, now I really understand the nature and complexity of biological life. In terms of serious standards, we don't have an adequate historical record for the Darwinian theory. We don't have a mathematical proof that anything like Darwinian theory can achieve certain results of biological complexity.
Do we not have enough fossils?
Plenty of fossils. They don't seem to tell a coherent story. There are just too many places where the story is incomplete, missing, discontinuous, where it does not seem to comport with standard predictions of Darwinian theory, which suggests a continuous transformation of life on Earth. I mean, there are plenty of intermediates, no question about that, but that is not what's important in the theory. It's the places where the theory is lacking, not the places where the theory is satisfied.
Where does the theory break down?
The theory breaks down because it gives you absolutely no explanation. I want to know how a rich, complicated, throbbing, three-dimensional creature came into existence. All the theory tells me is that if something is valuable, it will survive, provided it's stable enough. That's not terribly interesting. I want to know how the human nervous system was created.
Well, it was certainly news, and it still seems like news, that your, you know, three-dimensional, 80-pound mammal or whatever got here by endless variations over an almost endless period of time, slowly. And
such is the claim, but that claim is easy to make. Let's see a proof that there's a realistic possibility. Let's see a computer simulation which shows the claim. Let's see a convincing historical record. Or let's see the generation of complex life forms under laboratory conditions. Those are four obvious constraints placed in any theory of evolution, and Darwin's theory fails them all, lamentably, obviously.
When the line is that, wait a second, no, this is an algorithmic process, there is a kind of built-in formula to change, vary every once in a while, would you expect a more predictable, more regular, more systematic, obviously progressive set of changes, or what? In other words, what does the algorithm device do to the whole argument for or against Darwinism?
I don't think the concept of the algorithm plays a very significant role in terms of Darwinian theory. I mean, it's there for ceremonial purposes. It's a little bit like an elaborate headdress a particularly Rococo costume. Mm-hmm. In terms of the theory itself, the theory is so loose, so flabby, so lacking in content that we really cannot say beyond certain obvious respects what the theory predicts. I don't know of any especially salient predictions made by Darwinian theory that are not on the level of the trivial. One thing Darwinian theory does predict is a continuous spectrum of life forms, and that we don't see. But I don't think that the algorithm is a concept that has yet shown to be of any use in terms of biological generation, change, or complexity. Hmm. Not yet. Although it's a powerful and disturbing metaphor. That's true.
You call the algorithm the idea that rules the world, but that doesn't explain a lot of things it's supposed to. 1-800-423...
Not that it's supposed to. I'm not claiming it's
supposed
to. Or
that people want it to.
That's a different issue.
Okay. 1-800-423-8255, the algorithm connection. Randy is calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts.
Well, you've taken the discussion into evolution away from the original discussion of algorithms. The question I had was about the definition of the term algorithm to begin with. Is it something that is it has to be infused with the human spirit, or is it something that can exist outside the human spirit? In other words, when I teach my
children... Good question.
Terrific question. And I hesitate in answering it because it is such a deep and troubling question. As far as we know, there are no algorithms beyond the human community, just as there are no televisions that occur naturally in nature. Algorithms are created devices, they're human artifacts. And I'd like to stress, as far as we know, they belong to a very particular category of symbolic forms. That having been said, it is always tempting to speculate that there are other aspects of the universe that might similarly be infused with intelligence, as an algorithm is infused with intelligence. Where one might see that, how one might discover it, those are very difficult questions to answer. But I think the question is a very sensitive one.
Randy, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Jim is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Jim.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes. I wanted to ask Mr. Valenci two technical questions, if I may. Must algorithms always iterate, or at least have the capability to iterate? Earlier on, you were saying any computer program is an algorithm, and
right. The
idea occurred to me that perhaps all algorithms are programs, but not the reverse.
Well, I think iteration is built into the structure of most code. Whether it's iteration in terms of classical theory of recursive functions or not is a technical question. Recursive functions were designed to implement a certain process of iteration. Look, you can certainly have a computer program that doesn't iterate, that just executes.
Absolutely. I'm a software engineer, and
yeah.
What I think of as an algorithm is something that does iterate, and when you think of as classical computer language expressions like do, while,
sure.
for, they all set up initial conditions and have terminating conditions, and they're designed to iterate. That being said, let me ask you this question.
Ask away.
Objects and object orientation
have,
over the last decade or so, taken over the notion of algorithms. When I started programming, which is really before there was such a thing as computer science, algorithms were the thing that we were taught to write.
Sure.
Now, all that has sort of receded.
The algorithm is
not really taught.
It's receded from the obvious threshold of perception. But after all, every object-oriented language encapsulates an algorithm that's been antecedently written and designed. It's just hidden from the user.
David Berlinski is our guest. His book is The Advent of the Algorithm. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan is on the line.
Howdy.
Hello, Jonathan.
I this is actually not what I intended to note originally, but...
I'm not really who I said I was, so it's okay.
Natural selection and evolution is actually pretty well-founded as a theory, and, you know, there are considerable proof in molecular genetics and, you know, virus... in in microorganisms where we can create selective pressure and evolve them to be resistant to drugs.
No question of it. No question of it. That's absolutely correct. I mean, microevolution is a fact in terms of bacterial resistance, finch beak variation, and the like. Never intended to deny that selective pressures can induce small, relatively small changes within a bounded variation. That's absolutely true.
Okay. Then the point that I wanted to make is that in large parts of computer programming systems are essentially non-algorithmic. When you talk about computer networks, there isn't a sequence of steps and there doesn't seem to be a goal. What you described those as finite state automata, isn't that perhaps the more fundamental? Because you can actually deal with algorithms in terms of finite state automata. It's a little bit hard to go the other way around.
I'm not sure exactly of your question. I mean, the most general definition of an algorithm outstrips the power of a finite state automata. You have to use a Turing machine to completely capture the notion of a computable process. A finite state automata is a truncated Turing machine, but we know very well that what it can execute is markedly less than what a Turing machine can execute. So it's quite true that in certain places the correct description of a computer network, or for that matter an automatic elevator, might be in terms of finite state automata. But that doesn't alter the fundamental point that in terms of concepts we need the full power of algorithmic theory.
Jonathan, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Gene is on the line. Hello, Gene.
Yes, I'm a professor of computer science, so this is more or less you're talking about my profession, and I'd like to clarify a few things, if I may,
sure,
about the algorithm. I think that the notion of algorithm, which in spirit can be traced to the ancient Greeks, as has been pointed, it's inherently in elements of Euclid, the name of algorithm actually comes from Al-Khwarizmi, a Muslim mathematician in the middle centuries. The notion of algorithm is really focused on trying to disambiguate certain issues. And the reason it came to light so sharply in this century is because the mathematics came to a point where there were a couple of things which were kept ambiguous, like infinity, for
sure,
example.
Sure, that's absolutely right. Algorithmic theory has its roots in the 19th century crisis of mathematical thinking.
Exactly. So in that sense, the algorithm clarifies and focuses on the notion of locality, which is the principle of the modern science in general. It's an explicit principle which it advocates. So therefore, I agree with David when he says that saying that things are algorithmic in modern science is a triviality. It basically says, yes, we're looking at things in the way that modern science is looking at things, which means locality, which means algorithmic. Now, I wanted to address a little bit about the notions of complexity that you brought up in the beginning of the program.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of complexity is not necessarily at all about the number of iterations.
No,
or
of course
the complexity.
Not.
The notion of complexity can be reduced to the notion of, first of all, the complexity of the description, of describing something. How long a program do I need to write?
That's the Chait and Kolmogorov theory of algorithmic complexity, and it's a profound and interesting theory, but I'm not sure it's the entire explanation.
Right. The Chait and Kolmogorov describes the time-unbounded case of complexity, and that's the truly algorithmic complexity theory.
Gene, bring it home, as we say. We're running out of time.
If you look at it from this point of view, that the algorithm is a tool for disambiguating statements, then many of the issues disappear. Many of the questions become trivial questions. So if you ask, is there a human spirit or not, it's a language thing. It's almost like a formalism. It's a formalism of a new generation of thinking, of the new step of the evolution of mathematics,
think I agree with you that the question, is there a human spirit, is a triviality that can be answered very easily by any appeal to the concept of an algorithm.
I'm not sure he said exactly that, but did we locate the human spirit in this hour?
It's right in my book.
A good place for it, too. David Brilinski, thank you enormously.
My pleasure.
This actually connects with so many other conversations we have on the connection, algorithmically anyway. The book is called The Advent of the Algorithm, which David Brilinski calls the second great idea of Western science after calculus. He calls it the idea that rules the world. Thank you. And
My
thanks,
pleasure.
As always, to the amazingly erudite and generous and articulate callers to The Connection. David Berlinski will be at Wordsworth Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock in Cambridge, signing your book. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Inktomi, home to the builders of the Internet infrastructure. Inktomi, scaling the Internet at inktomi.com. By Quo Vadis on Newbury Street, planning cultural tours for...